from deep inside your radio. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week. Leading off the show.
We're so sorry.
Get off it.
Mr. Shepard Smith.
Well, some explaining to do. While we were taking that car chase and showing it to you live, when the guy pulled over and got out of the vehicle, we went on delay. So that's why I didn't talk for about 10 seconds. We created a 5-second delay, as if you were to bleep back your DVR 5 seconds. That's what we did with the picture we were showing you, so that we would see in the studio what was happening 5 seconds before you did, so that if anything went horribly wrong, we'd be able to cut away from it without subjecting you to it. And we really messed up. And we're all very sorry. That didn't belong on TV. We took every precaution we knew how to take to keep that from being on TV. And I personally apologize to you that that happened. Sometimes we see a lot of things that we don't let get to you because it's not time appropriate, it's insensitive, it's just wrong. And that was wrong. And that won't happen again on my watch. And I'm sorry. We'll update you on what happened with that guy and how that went down tonight on the Fox Report. I'm sorry.
Not too sorry to get a promo in, babe. Well done. Shepard Smith on Fox News Channel after he narrated live a live car chase that ended in the driver pulling into out into the desert and killing himself live on Fox News. And then this. Fox News Channel has released a statement explaining what happened when it inadvertently aired a man shooting himself in the head following a car chase. Quote, "We took every precaution to avoid any such live incident by putting the helicopter pictures on a 5-second delay. Unfortunately, this mistake was the result of a severe human error, and we apologize for what viewers ultimately saw on the screen." That's from Michael Clementi, Executive Vice President for News. Yes, at Fox News. A Fox News source tells MediaBistro.com that a producer on the broadcast failed to hit the dump button in time. I know we've all had that experience, usually in early childhood. Another media apology this week, almost as humiliating, maybe more so. The BBC has apologized to the Queen after its security correspondent Frank Gardner recounted on the air a private conversation in which the Queen told him she had lobbied the British equivalent of the Interior Secretary to secure the arrest of Abu Hamza al-Masri, the radical Islamist cleric. Gardner said the Queen personally told him she was aghast that Abu Hamza, who now faces imminent extradition to the U.S. except for a certain legal thing, she was aghast that he could not be arrested during the period when he regularly aired vehemently anti-British views as the imam of a mosque in North London, like he had free speech or something. The Queen supposedly never expresses overtly political views in public. The convention for people conversing with her is that whatever is said remains off the record. During an interview with BBC Radio 4's Today program, yes, Jim Bell, you're right, the Today program is newsier than GMA. It's just the British one. About the wider issue of his newly approved extradition to the United States, referring to Abu Hamza, Gardner said of his former activities, there was a sense that the British intelligence agency, MI5, had been too slow to realize how dangerous he was in radicalizing other people. He continued, "Actually, I can tell you that the Queen was pretty upset. There was no way to arrest him. She couldn't understand. Surely there had been some law that he had broken." In the end, sure enough, he was. There was. He was eventually convicted and sentenced for 7 years for soliciting murder and racial hatred. A clearly surprised host of the program, James Naughty, described this revelation in the conversation as, quote, "a corker." Gardner said, quote, "Yes, I thought I'd drop that in. She told me." She spoke to the Home Secretary at the time, and he said, "Surely this man must have broken some laws. Why is he still at large? He was conducting these radical activities, and he called Britain a toilet. He was incredibly anti-British, and yet he was sucking up money from this country for a long time." Unquote. The BBC reported that the BBC had written to Buckingham Palace to express their regret You apologized to a palace in this country, apparently. And that the conversation should have stayed private. Gardner's comments were, quote, wholly inappropriate, the letter said, adding that the BBC correspondent was himself, personally, very sorry. A Buckingham Palace spokeswoman said she had no comment. Because if you apologize to a palace, you expect the palace to comment. The highly truncated but always imitated apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now, this broadcast is coming to you from London, but from now to the end, it's about New Orleans. And you may have heard about this week, ladies and gentlemen. Probably not. You may have seen the smoke emitting from certain pairs of ears, mine included. Here's the story. About 3 years ago, United States Federal District Court in New Orleans, under Judge Stanwood Duval, held a fairly lengthy and highly detailed trial. The only one at that time to come to trial regarding damage from the 2005 flood in New Orleans. And after, as I say, highly detailed technical testimony on both sides, great contention between the sides, the judge wrote a 150-plus page sizzling opinion coruscating the United States Army Corps of Engineers for negligence in the construction and design of the so-called Mississippi River Gulf Outlet, holding it responsible for the flooding of St. Bernard Parish, New Orleans East, and the Lower Ninth Ward, much of the flooding that occurred in 2005, and therefore entitling five of the six plaintiffs in the case to substantial damages, and thereby opening the door to potentially billions of dollars in damages for other folks in that area who were flooded by the same vector. March of this year, a three-judge panel of United States Circuit Court of Appeals right around the corner from the trial court upheld his decision unanimously. And this week, those same three judges reversed themselves in a one-and-a-half-page opinion, saying, oops, we didn't get the facts right. This is Rob Virchik, a professor of environmental law at Loyola, explaining a little more detail. The court tried to argue that its failure to armor the Mississippi River Gulf outlet to strengthen it against possible erosion and thereby a widening of the channel was a policy choice that weighed public risk against the cost of construction of the armoring and thereby entitled it to a immunity under the Federal Tort Claims Act for policy decisions. But neither, says Virchik, neither the trial court nor the appeals court the first time around bought that argument. That's because all the trial testimony showed the Corps officials never believed the erosion posed a safety risk. Every scientific study available at the time said they were wrong about that. But the point is that the decision to let the channel erode didn't happen because someone thought the public risk was worth it, but because no one thought there was a public risk. Here is the original Court of Appeals panel describing the evidentiary record in their original opinion last March. Quote, the plaintiffs point to ample record evidence indicating that policy played no role in the government's decision to delay armoring the Mr. Go. The district court found, as a matter of fact, that in maintaining the Mr. Go, the Corps labored under the mistaken scientific belief that it would not increase storm surge risks. And yet somehow after a few months, all of this got wobbly. Quote, there's ample record evidence indicating the public policy character of the Corps' various decisions contributing to the delay in armoring. So there was ample evidence saying it didn't have policy considerations. Now there's ample evidence saying it does. Presto, change-o. Professor Virchik says, if willful ignorance constitutes a policy choice, is there any incompetence that does not? He adds, we may never know what spirits swayed the three judges at this late date. The plaintiffs have before them the choice of appealing to the full nine-judge panel, of which those three were a third. There's your math for you. Or saying, there's no way to win. It's the feds. This is Le Show in New Orleans, Louisiana. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm sitting in the studio of a friend and one of the great musicians of New Orleans, and he visited this program maybe a decade ago.
I think so, yeah.
David Torkanowski. But then you were you had the cover of a drummer. Today people are going to get the privilege of hearing you play, I won't say naked because there are federal laws, but unaccompanied solo, and it is a treat indeed. David Torkanowski, welcome.
Thank you, Harry.
Well, I'm welcoming you to your own studio. But there.
Yes, but thank you for letting me on Le Show again after a decade.
How did you pronounce it?
Le Show.
Thank you. David, you have, and everybody in town knows this about you, and now you're going to wonder what the next part of this sentence is, but you have this amazing musical heritage. Your dad was the conductor of the symphony here.
That's right.
And your mom, who's still with us, is a flamenco performer, flamenco artist, yes?
Yeah, she is one of the foremost flamenco impresarios. I took her to Spain 10 years ago, for 15 years ago for Christmas, and they'd stop performances to acknowledge her presence. Mm. She danced with the great Carmen Amaya, a gypsy who pretty much was the John Coltrane of the art form. So,
the John Coltrane of flamenco.
Yeah, probably a stretch there.
But with this as a background, you grew up in this town. Did you always think you were destined to have a musical life?
I think so, yeah. I mean, music was around the house the whole time. My father had Itzhak Perlman and Eugenia Stoneman around the house. My mother had flamenco gypsies, and they all jammed together, and it was like I grew up not knowing any musical boundaries.
But that's a very different musical background than a lot of people in New Orleans had. Did you feel, as you started to meet other musical folks, that you were from a foreign place?
Not really, because my mother insisted that I be brought to Ellis Marsalis and Preservation Hall and Sweet Emma and Dave Paquette, and she really immersed me in that world, and then that world adopted me. So I was really lucky to catch the tail end of a great era.
Did you see Professor Longhair? I mean, you must have, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
In fact, when he died, I played his chair for the memorial concert, which I personally thought should have remained empty, but I wasn't going to say no.
When you say played his chair, for people listening, you played piano. You
didn't with his band, with his touring band.
There isn't a musical chair. I just want to make that.
Thank you.
There's a game of musical chairs, but you didn't. Thank you. And you saw Booker?
Oh, yeah, sure.
James Carroll Booker?
Many times.
Yeah.
Many times. I remember being in the studio when he was recording Classified. And, he was feeling really sick, really, going through withdrawals, whatever. And he was like, throwing up and just didn't want to be there. And Scott Billington, the great producer from Rounder Records, was exhorting him. Come on, Booker, just try one time. These studio musicians, the clock was ticking, nothing was going on. Finally, they started, I think it was the title track of the tune, Classified.
Mm-hmm.
And, Booker was, started playing, and then all of a sudden he seemed to really be getting into it. His head was down between his hands, and the producer was going, all right, it's great, he's finally getting into it. What had happened, though, during the intro, Booker's teeth fell out onto the piano keyboard, and he was trying to pick them up without stopping playing. If you listen to the track real closely, you can hear a little tick and where his teeth are hitting the keyboard.
Was that an ultrasonic?
It was.
Wow.
Yeah.
The long-gone ultrasonic.
Right. It's four or five storms ago took that out.
Yeah. That's amazing. So you got to see the legends that of that era.
Oh, absolutely. Toots Washington. Wow. I mean, I saw Fats a few times, of course. This town has an incredible legacy of pianists.
Yeah.
From Louis Moreau Gatcho to your boy John Cleary.
And so many more. Before we go any further, play something for us.
All right, cool. I'm going to play this tune that's going to be on my upcoming record.
What?
That's right. This tune is called Less Than Three. And it's kind of a happy tune. I like it.
Because you're such a happy guy.
I am. I'm you're especially happy when I kick your ass on the basketball court.
Oh, you're editing this. Well, then you're not happy very often.
Paul Harvey, good day.
What was that, a minor 4/13th chord you ended up on?
4 minor, subdominant minor.
There
but
you go.
You're a bass player. You don't need to know harmony.
I don't know. I don't need to know. I don't need to know anything. I just need to know where the one is.
So that tune was called Less Than Three,
mm-hmm.
which for those who text a lot is kind of a sideways heart. Less than three, you see.
Look at you.
You see.
Yeah. Well, you are the sideways heart.
Kind of a thing.
Yeah. that should be your T-shirt if it isn't already.
But anyway, that's going to be included on a new record that I'm recording now called Fancy.
Wow.
And
is that named after the produce? You know,
no.
That's a grade of produce.
It is.
Yeah.
It is.
Fancy.
Yeah.
Yeah. But what is it named after?
It's just an adjective to describe something.
Because in Britain, it's also a verb.
Do you fancy?
Do you fancy going out to...
Well, there's the double entendre I never intended.
Ah, okay. Well, right. That's my contribution to the record.
So that'll be coming out in late fall.
Really?
Yeah, and look for it on my website, torkanowski.com.
Torkanowski.com.
Mm-hmm.
No David.
No.
As of now, the music scene, to my eye and ear, seems to have bounced back remarkably from the disaster. How does it feel like to somebody who's working in it?
I must tell you that I'm a DJ on WWOZ 90.7 FM New Orleans, or WWOZ.org around the world. And one of my first shows back, I was astounded to read the live music listing. There was 50 or 60 live band events. I mean, there wasn't enough people in New Orleans, but yet the music is what came back first. Now, there's something that never recovered from Katrina, which is the diaspora of the musical families that happened. I mean, people got split up, sent to different parts of the country, and some of those never came back. I mean, they went to Nebraska and got a good job and went to good schools, and, well, this doesn't suck. I think I'll stay. The point is, the Katrina was a watershed event in our city's culture.
You think it interrupted those lines?
It'll never be the same. It'll be not going to be better or worse. It'll just never be the same. It was a continuum that lasted for a couple hundred years, or let's say 100 years or 150 years. It was a continuum that was profoundly interrupted.
Do you know any of those folks who got scattered?
Certainly.
Yeah.
Oh, certainly.
What percentage of them do you think would like to come back, and what percentage you think are very happy where they are?
Couldn't put a percentage on it, but I know of a few people that will never come back.
Of their own, because of how they feel about it?
Because of how they feel. Their house was completely destroyed. They had no insurance, or their insurance screwed them, or whatever, all manner of bad things here or good things there conspired to keep them where they are. They may not have the means to, because it did take a certain amount of resources to reestablish this city. I mean, this city is a unique state of mind that everybody had to want it, and those who didn't want it didn't come back.
You know, it struck me very strange. A couple of years ago, I asked Allison Plyer, who is at the outfit here that kind of specializes in gathering statistics on New Orleans and reporting them in conjunction with the Brookings Institution on how the city is doing. I said, has anybody...
Oh, I'm sorry. Did you mean the Brookings Institute?
No, it's Brookings Institution.
Is it really?
Yeah, I think it is. Brookings. Let's just call it Brookings. It's the place Nixon wanted to firebomb.
Right.
Whether anybody had done a job of following those people and finding out how they were doing in any large-scale statistical way, how they were, more than 100,000 evacuees, non-returnees.
No.
How they were doing. How many wanted to come back, how many were okay. No. Nobody has ever done that. Nobody's ever done it.
First of all, I mean, there is some thinking that there was a specific agenda to essentially erase a predominantly black city. Then nobody cares about the culture. This is America. Nobody cares about the culture.
Why do you hate freedom?
I hate America, clearly. I wrote a letter to Dennis Hastert, the Speaker of the House at the time after Katrina. I'm surprised the Secret Service didn't knock on my door. That's how venom-filled it was after he suggested, oh, if people want to hear jazz, they can go to Disney World. So, no, people don't care. People don't care. And, some people maintain that there was a specific, culturally ethnic cleansing, ethnic cleansing agenda regarding this city. This was a welfare city. Everybody was lazy, whatever. And nobody wanted to rebuild it. And when I went to the Super Bowl, I sat next to an Indianapolis Colts fan, and when they started showing the pregame film of the Superdome, he goes, oh, my God, not this again. I'm so tired of... And I leaned over to him, and I said, it's better to watch it than having lived through it. And then, words were getting heated, and I said, listen, let me just say, we paid a lot of money to be here. Let's not, let's just watch the game. Mm. And,
can't take you anywhere. Yeah. What I was going to ask about, though, in terms of the music life here, is in terms of number of venues, it seems to have kind of stabilized. I mean, we've lost a couple of amazing places that I loved, Donna's and Funky Butt, but new ones have sprung up. There seems to be a sort of a consistent level of places. How is it in a city where rents have risen, cost of living is considerably higher than it was pre-flood, how is it economically to be a musician in this city right now? I'm going to tread the line of absurdity and say, has the money being paid to musicians gone up accordingly?
No, absolutely not. Matter of fact, if anything, it's gone a little down. I mean, you have clubs that make it their business to compensate musicians, such as Snug Harbor. And then you have clubs that make it their business to have musicians just play for the door, like Chickiwawa. So the point is, both venues are valid.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as the economic impact to musicians, we need more of the former and less of the latter. And, I mean, clubs like Chickiwawa wouldn't be open if there weren't people there, people that were available to play.
Yeah.
I mean, that were willing to play there.
Yeah.
No. To be a musician in this town, you have to diversify. You have to be willing to work a lot. But to a musician living somewhere else, that sounds like heaven because they can't work a lot.
Gigging 4 or 5 nights a week in different kinds of aggregations.
Multiple times a night.
Yeah, in different groupings with different...
That's it. And that's really why I live here, because I get all the musicians I play are destined to be in the Smithsonian. They're all killer musicians, from Shannon Powell to Evan Christopher, Nicholas Payton. They're are the best musicians in the world.
Yeah.
And I get to go from playing on a bandstand with Zigaboo Model East to playing, like tonight I'm playing with Dee Dee Bridgewater. I can really expand my musical palette here.
Zigaboo, for listeners, is the original drummer of the Meters.
And he is he's the Elvin Jones of New Orleans funk player. He's amazing.
Now, there's a John Coltrane reference and an Elvin Jones reference. Dating yourself, or are you just having a good time?
Well, like Nicholas Payton says, jazz died in 1959. Nothing was cool after that.
Play something else for us.
All right.
For the tip jar, the radio tip jar.
All right. Thank you.
Wow, what was that? Unlike your radio show, you have to back announce the music on this show.
Okay. That was Nardis.
Is Nardis. By Miles?
Yeah, some people say Wayne Shorter wrote it, but yeah. Miles is credited with writing it.
You walk among several worlds in the city. It's an easy city, I guess, in some ways to cross lines that aren't so easy to cross in other cities. But you have been a denizen at some times of some of the chambers in City Hall. Yes?
I don't know what denizen means.
You've occupied them? You've inhabited them?
What? I mean, I've never
not
held
run
office.
For it. No, but you've had meetings. You know how to...
I'm involved in some of the politics of,
okay,
of this
Okay, this
town,
is not a
sure.
trial.
Okay. depends on what the meaning of the word is.
That's right. So, one hears all the time from people in the... particularly in what we call the cultural community, but particularly the music community of New Orleans, this city doesn't promote, enhance in any way, seem to acknowledge the, and I'm talking about the official city, the importance of music to the life of the city and to the economic life of the city. Is that a true statement?
Oh, I think so. Now, you know, our current mayor, Mitch Landrieu, I did serve on a... cultural economy task force during his transition, but
see what I mean, ladies and gentlemen, a denizen.
the realities of it are, we're transitioning from being a post Katrina federally supported city to a city that has to support itself on a ever shrinking tax base. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, personally, I feel that this is a cultural destination, and if you dedicated the assets to really showcasing the incredibly unique culture of this city, not only, well, the musicians, of course, the food, everybody knows what they are, but
although they don't know the depth of the visual arts community here at all.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, now we have, absolutely. This city has everything from Euro, avant-garde, electronica to complete trad music. And when I say trad, I don't mean Dixieland. That's what it became when it left here. New Orleans traditional music. It's still alive and well here, but this city embraces so much culture. Mm-hmm. It's got more culture per capita. We are the live music capital of the world. There is no more live music anywhere in the world per capita than in this city. The galleries, I mean, it's an amazingly unique and diverse city that if the powers that be were to sell that, it would be extraordinarily successful.
Well,
and
you know,
people just don't regard it as entertainment and don't think that it's a real industry, but it absolutely is.
Yeah, I mean, I think... In the years before the flood, the city sort of relaxed and let its promotion be taken care of by the Budweiser people, and
absolutely
they got what they deserved, which is tourists who come here to get drunk and play Saints.
Right, and they'll throw change at a tap dancer.
Yeah,
which is how they regard all performing musicians, and it's so much deeper than that. And this is the home of Wynton Marsalis. This is the home of Nicholas Payton. This is the home of Trombone Shorty. Musicians that can redefine any bandstand they're on with any musical style that they happen to be playing.
Yeah.
Depth beyond words. Because what's different about here? The ancestry is still in the air, is still in the wood. I mean, there are musicians here that are still channeling the ancestry. That's the difference between music played here. Vodakovich has a theory.
This is drummer Johnny Vodakovich.
Right. Just generally in the world, as you get closer to the equator, music is more of the body. As you get toward the northern latitudes, it becomes more cerebral.
Hmm.
And we are the beachhead of African culture in America. And this, the music that we call American music was born of the confluence of African and European influence that happened here. And this is a very, very heavy place. That's why, at considerable cost to my own career, I still live here.
You did enhance your career a few years ago. You did, listeners who may have seen the film The Big Uneasy, you did the score for that movie as an enormous favor to me.
I did it as a favor because I've personally witnessed the wrath of people that work for you.
They cross me?
Yes. I prefer to remain your friend.
But you've done more of that? Have you?
Yeah. Sure. That's what I do. I mean, when I'm talking about we have to diversify, mm-hmm. I don't do anything but music, but I also, I'm a film composer. I compose for episodic television. I did the music for the Big Easy.
Done both the Big Easy and the Big Uneasy.
Yes. I just finished a film, a really interesting film, documentary that looks into the charter school issue. Versus, because we were the petri dish for the charter school movement.
Yeah.
Called The Experiment, which is an very interesting film.
Does it take sides?
It does. It does. It's a little pro-charter, it's a little anti-traditional schools, but a very interesting look at it from the Department of Education down to the principal of Gregory, whose hands are tied. He can't hire or fire teachers because, you know, his hands are tied by the teachers union. Mm. So it's, you know, how relevant is the teachers union? That's what it looks into.
It's such a strange story because when I was a kid, I taught school for a couple of years. And in those days, this is when dinosaurs ruled the public schools, the teachers unions were just coming in. And it seemed to be the necessary reform of the day. Mm. Because principals had unbridled authority and used it to sort of reward and punish favorites that, without regard to whether they necessarily were effective in the classroom or not. So now here we are at the other end of that process a few years on, and it seems to be, you know, the same problem in a different guise. And yet, you know, there are those who fear, and I'm not among them, but I acknowledge that this fear is around, that there's a move now to privatize public schools overall. You know?
Well, they consider charter schools to be essentially private schools using public buildings, using public money, and disenfranchising parental input. The other side of that argument is, what parental input? Yeah. So, I mean, gone are the days where you and I grew up in, there was actually PTAs and parents sat down and helped you with homework. I mean, that's the exception, not the rule these days.
Parents helped you with homework?
You know.
So you did music for that?
I did. And it was called The Experiment. And it's essentially a 90-minute news package, but it's a very interesting documentary.
Coming out when?
It's out. It's on Starz Network right now. Uh-huh. And they're talking to me about...
Getting out of their house?
They're asking me to look at a pilot.
Oh, cool.
For another series, sort of like The Big Easy. So it's important to diversify in music. I produce events. I play piano for various and sundry people. You know, music I like to play. So I like to treat... So far, I've been successful at keeping it just music.
You were in a band for a number of years, which has some... fame in among jazz aficionados, Astral Project. Mm-hmm. How do you compare life being a freelancer as you are now with having been in an aggregation for a number of years?
Oh, well, we were freelancers when we had that band, of course. How do I compare it? I mean, it's just the same, exactly the same. I just don't have to comp untold number of choruses for somebody. No, sorry. That's an interesting question. I miss playing with those guys. I just played a trio gig with the rhythm section, and it was amazing. It was magical. It was like the communication, the intimacy of communication, it never left. I mean, we're playing a tempo, and it's like all of a sudden I stop, and everybody stops without cue. It's like I'll change tempo. Everybody's there. It was scary, scary how intimate that was. And so I think we're going to do it some more.
Oh, great. Well, you are one of the first things I noticed when I'd seen you perform live is, and I'm sure I'm not the first person to say this to you, you have, maybe because your father was a conductor, you look like a born leader in a group, in a performing situation. You know?
Some of that, yeah. Some of that is inherent in the instrument. The pianist is essentially the MD of
music director.
Is the music director of a group.
Of the group.
Somewhat. It depends. It depends. A lot of aggregations in this city are unrehearsed.
Yeah.
So, you know, incredible musicians come together and it sounds seamless. But someone has to direct traffic. If only to count it off and cue a solo.
And I mean, it's extremely subtle. And you have to, like, you know, you're not standing there waving your arms like a conductor, but you're making... Yeah, I see signals that you send, you know, for various changes that you think it's time for.
Otherwise, it'll be kind of monochromatic.
Yeah.
If orchestration is not willed upon it, or if it doesn't happen organically, it's better to change the timbre on purpose than to not have it change at all.
Mm.
It's I used to do that for many years behind Diane Reeves, and she
did she know about it?
Yeah, she didn't really know about it until she saw the first video. She said, "What are you doing?" But yeah, so that was that's kind of what it's inherent in the instrument, and I guess inherent in my approach to ensemble playing.
Mm. Somebody got to shape it.
I think so. Yeah. I think so. You know, it's a challenge to turn that off, because there's groups where other people have the vision.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to give 60% and take 40% of the space and the energy. So,
Play one more thing for us.
I will. I would just like to say that I'm appearing this December in Chicago, in New York, with Harry and Judith's Christmas show.
We haven't signed the papers.
No. We talked about it at dinner last night.
There have been conversations.
All right. What do you want to hear, man?
What you got? Whatever. I don't David Torganowski. I should. What was that? That was a composition, or was that improvised?
No. That was a tune I'm sending out to Judith called "Sorry I Asked."
We're talking about David Torkanowski in New Orleans. You've got a solo record coming out in November.
Yeah, beginning of November.
And what else you got going on?
Before that,
wow.
There's a release of a band that that I've been working with. It's my band called Fleur Debris.
I get it.
Yeah, and the members on the record are George Porter Jr. from
wow.
the Meters on. Killer drummer Simon Lott.
Sure.
One of my compadres from the Astral Project, Tony DeGrotti.
Yeah,
on tenor saxophone.
Tenor saxophone.
And myself. And the record actually was recorded here in the studio during a party. And we were the band for the party. But the music was so killing that I've been editing on this ever since. I mean, you hear conversation in the background, glasses clinking, you know, like a Bill Evans record. And, it's really a lot of fun. Currently, the band is Aaron Fletcher on alto saxophone, George Porter on bass, Zigaboo Modalist on drums, and myself. We played Jazz Fest a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I remember
and,
that.
And up on my website, just when the record's released, will be video from that performance, free download. Torkanowski.com, TORKANOWSKY.COM.
Free download.
Yes. Got to give it away, babe.
T-shirts, mugs, tote bags?
Just available at the live gigs.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right. And
it's all about
there.
Merch, baby.
Yeah.
All right. So Fleur Debris is coming out first, and then my solo record, Fancy, will be coming out later in the fall.
You're a machine. Just to make sure all the information is out there, David has produced at least one track on every one of the records I've done. Including the track with Dr. John and the aforementioned Nicholas Payton, Herlin Riley on drums. And
oh, that was fun.
Roland Guerin on bass called Autumn in New Orleans. A record which is out now.
It is.
Yeah.
And
so,
it's being received to the acclaim of hundreds.
We're hoping for the high hundreds.
Was a lot of fun to
yeah,
do, by the way. It
that
really
was. Going back one more time to this subject of live music in the city. There's something that purports to be or is alleged to be a war on live music going on here.
That's not new.
Really?
That's not new. This city has a history of corner bars and just corner restaurants having live music. This goes back to
the invention of the corner.
Exactly. To the first days of the corner. And, you know, there's people that think, oh, well, you know, the quiet neighborhoods are more important and, you know, the property values. So there's always been a tug of war between, and to be quite honest, there's been a lot of irresponsible club owners that let patrons just go out and all, you know, leave the club late at night through residential neighborhoods, all loud, urinating on lawns and stuff like that. I mean, so, yeah, there's been. The fault is on both sides, and there's a constant fight in this town, a zoning fight, to shut down live music venues and to prevent new ones from opening.
When I heard that there was, you know, folks trying to shut down some of Frenchman Street, it seemed a little shocking because...
I was involved in the effort that resulted in the cultural zoning overlay, which is how they put it, to allow music on Frenchman Street. Now, when music first started on Frenchman Street, it was very organic, very almost bohemian, really, really wonderful. But here's an example of what I'm talking about. It's become a secondary Bourbon Street.
Mm-hmm.
Open doors, loud music out of the open doors in what is essentially a residential neighborhood.
Yeah.
So... to shut down, I mean, yeah, what you're seeing is the backlash to that lack of discipline on the part of the club owners, on the part of the musicians, and yeah, that's to be expected. You got to be a responsible member of the mosaic, so to speak.
Wow,
I know it's heavy, isn't it?
Look at you.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, we're it's weird because we're living in an era where both technology and, I'm going to use a word that doesn't really belong here, aesthetics dictate that music just gets louder and louder.
Kind of. And unfortunately, the history of this town is completely unamplified organic music being played where the sound bounces off wood that's as old as this country. So, which is, you know, part of the magic of Preservation Hall. That's what happens. There's no amplification. The wood is old. The music is new, even though, and it's organic. The problem is you also have a rock scene in this town. I mean, it's like I was alluding to earlier. There's so many different types of music in this town. There's rock, there's funk music, there's electronica.
There's even a little bluegrass in this town.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And especially on Bourbon Street, you know, music is amplified to get patrons in. And, you know, now Frenchman Street is starting to follow suit, and it's not appropriate. It's not appropriate.
Strange thing, though, is that just any given night, recent vintage automobile with its windows open and its sound system cranked is probably louder than most clubs in town.
That's true. Absolutely. You know, so. What I wouldn't give for that low end in my studio. But that's true. I mean, noise pollution happens wherever.
Yeah.
The problem is you can pull that car over, give it a ticket.
Oh, that happens. That happens on the planet Zell.
But you can't, you know, if you're going to pull a club over to give it a ticket, that means shutting it down. Yeah. That means a place that musicians were trying to make a living can no longer. Mm. So, you know, it requires communication.
What?
Yeah, communication. Yeah. And you know, this town is perfectly capable of it. The city is quite amazing. It's got divisions in it that were formed during Reconstruction that still occur today. It's not black or white. It's shade.
Mm.
It's not rich or poor, because rich and poor live together in this city. It's not like a good area and a bad area. You go two blocks over, and the demographic changes.
Yeah.
The city is an incredible fabric with an incredible patina.
Wow. All right, with those words ringing in our ears, play us out with something kind of up-tempo, if you'd be so kind, so I can yak over it.
Okay, you know, the tip jar is right there.
You got it. Hold on. I didn't bring my wallet.
Okay.
Going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ on the Mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived wherever you want at harryshearer.com and kcrw.com, available for your smartphone through stitcher.com, and available as a free podcast through kcrw.com. Tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Hawaii, and Chicago desks. Thanks to Pam Halstead. This broadcast is on Twitter. Our email address and the playlist of the music is at the newly refurbished harryshearer.com. And thanks to all the folks at Scoring Works at Storyville Post. And there aren't that many of those folks, for help with today's broadcast. And thanks to Torque. The show comes to you from Century Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized as the home of the rubber promise and the home of the homeless. So long from London.